Well, first of all, I want you to open up into the Old Testament just to look at a verse into the book of Joel. And there's many Old Testament prophecies, of course, dealing with Israel. Sometimes the prophets in the Old Testament are calling Israel and telling them to get back on track with the law of Moses that God had given to them. Other times the prophets were speaking of a future prophecy, but yet something that would take place yet in the Old Testament, like the return from Babylon or the destruction of a nation or something that was oppressing Israel at that time. But many of these prophecies then extend into the distant future yet that haven't taken place. So there was, within the prophecy of the Old Testament, there was a teaching and correction for them at that time, prophecy for the near future and prophecy for the distant future. But just to start off tonight, I want to look in Joel chapter 3. And this chapter here that Joel is talking or speaking in is talking of a day towards the end of time. And I'm going to draw a timeline on the board right here, something that you're familiar with. Nothing's going to be too much different from what you've seen before. We'll put the cross on here, 30 A.D. Back here was the Old Testament. This was the age of Israel. Many other things we could talk about back there. But God had called Israel. They were the client nation that God used to reach the world. Not only were they chosen by God and He gave them the law, but the whole purpose was that Israel would go to the world with the truth, because the world was in darkness after the fall of man and the decline of all the nations. As you remember, there was at one time only one mass of people, one nation before Babel. And then at Babel, God confused the languages, divided the people up. And there were 70 nations came out of that. You can read about that in the early chapters of Genesis, the table of nations. Some came from each of Noah's sons. All 70 of these nations went off into darkness. They rejected the truth of God. And so God called one man, Abram, and said, I'll make a nation out of you, and all nations will be blessed through you. So ultimately, Israel's purpose is to bless the nations by bringing them the truth. And all blessings come from the truth. I mean, if you whatever you're talking about, it's got to begin with the truth, the absolute foundation that we are built on, this reality that God created. You reject God's reality, you reject truth, there's no blessing. I mean, you're living in darkness. And so what does it mean, bless all nations? That means present to them the foundational truths of God and His doctrine, His creation, that they would walk in that light and find life, find blessing. Well, anyway, Israel had some roller coaster experiences. Ultimately, Assyria took 10 of them, 10 of the tribes, and dispersed them right around 700 B.C., and then beginning in 605, they had the Babylonian captivity, where they went to Babylon for 70 years, but they returned. After 70 years of captivity, they returned, and they didn't make the same mistakes they made before, mainly idol worship. They made some corrections. And then Israel was going to then continue until their Messiah came. And we're going to pick this up here in just a moment. After Jesus Christ came, he said some things, and basically he started the church. I'll show you some verses tonight. He began the church, because in 30 A.D., the Israelites actually rejected the king. They rejected the Messiah. He shows up to bring them the truth. He became, and no longer speaking to them through prophets or visions or dreams, he showed up and says, I'm him. And they says, no, you're not, you're Satan, basically. Well, look at the verse. And he says, this isn't going over very well. And he's going to have to find someone to replace. And he's going to take this time period now of what we know as the church age. And the church age had a beginning, and there's going to be an end of the church age. So far, we can call it at this time a 2,000-year period. It may be longer. Obviously, it's not going to end right now. It's still going on. But it's right around the 2,000-year mark. When it ends, no one really knows. But when that ends, when the church age ends, Israel, who was rejected in 30 A.D., is going to resurface, because there's many prophecies, for example, this one that we're looking at here tonight, that have not yet been fulfilled. One of them is the seven-year tribulation called the time of Jacob's trouble. It's a time of testing of Israel. It's a time for them to make their final decision, but also for Israel to do what they were originally appointed to do, is be a light to the world. And we looked at Revelation at different times, but there will be great revival during this seven-year period as Israel does its job, but many decisions that are made, both for and against God. At the end of the seven-year period, Jesus Christ returns to the planet to set up a thousand-year reign. Now, this is where I get this from reading the Bible literally, meaning this is what it says. If you begin to spiritualize these prophecies, you can go off into a number of different directions, which are all, some people say, good, and that's fine. But I read it literally, and there are prophecies coming after Jesus returns and judges the world, prophecies of a reign, a kingdom reign, a millennial reign, where he is the king of the earth. So basically, when we break this down, from Adam to Abraham, there was a 2,000-year period, and that's pretty basic. I mean, that's not, you know, you can't really negotiate that and say, well, I think, you know, that's pretty much the standard. From Abraham to Jesus, there's no real doubt about it that there was a 2,000-year period from the call of Abraham until Jesus came. And we were talking like 2,042 years or, 40, you know, something like that. And it's been about 2,000 years since Jesus came, and he is going to return again. Then there's a 1,000-year reign at the end that gives you a total of 6,000 years of human history. Excuse me, 7,000 years of human history when you add the millennium. This is known as the Sabbath rest, which matches up with the 7 days of creation, 6 days of man's time of working with the 1,000-year of a Sabbath rest. Well, we'll still be working, but it's going to be a time of peace. Okay, now in Joel, we're talking towards the end here of what is going to take place. And it says, in those days, and at that time, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem. There's a lot of talk of a restoration. There's a lot of talk of a bringing back of Israel. I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. There I will enter into judgment against them concerning my inheritance, my people Israel. So ultimately, if I were to develop this for you, this judgment is taking place when Jesus Christ returns to judge the world. He, you know, he splits the sky, comes back, the battle of Armageddon, the sheep and goat judgments where he divides in Matthew 25, where he divides the goats on his left and the sheep on his right, and the judges the nations. He sits on his throne in heavenly glory in Jerusalem, which hasn't taken place. It means if that's going to be fulfilled, he's got to come back and be seated in heavenly glory in Jerusalem and judge the nations, which this is talking about. It's not like we're just talking about one verse. But notice it says, I will enter into judgment against them, the nations, concerning my inheritance, my people Israel. One of the bases of judgment is going to be, and the sheep and goat judgment is about that too. He says, if you've done it to the least of these, my brethren, and Jesus' brethren, him being Jewish, are the Jewish people. And that during the tribulation, one of the decisions people have to make is, how are you going to treat the Jewish people, the brethren of Jesus? Now, if they say, we don't believe in the Israelites, we don't believe Israel should be a nation, we don't want them here, that would be a negative response. If you see Israel as being the fulfillment of the promise of God, of Jesus the Messiah is coming back to deliver them, you'd have a different view. So the world, that's why the world, I mean, we're going to look at a few things here. That is why the world today is against Israel, because the world is against the Messiah. Stop right here. Go to Psalm chapter 2. Keep your place there. We're coming back to Joel. I'm not done. I haven't even got to the point I want to talk about. Joel chapter 2, verse 1, excuse me, Psalms chapter 2. This is the classic verse of the nation's response towards God, or the nation's response towards the Messiah, the king. Remember, there's going to be a king. His name is Jesus, and he will reign in his kingdom. He will reign over all of the nations. He will be the emperor, in a sense. Zechariah 14 calls him the king of the whole world. And so he will be the emperor, and there'll be kings underneath him. But in Psalm 2, it says, why do the nations conspire and the people plot in vain? I mean, they're conspiring. They're trying to get away with something. They've got a plot, but God says, why do they keep doing this? The kings of the earth take their stand for war, and the rulers gather together against the Lord, that's Yahweh, and against his anointed one. The Lord is, Yahweh is the Hebrew word, and anointed one there, if it's it would be the Hebrew word Messiah, which is the Greek word Christ, or Christos means the anointed one. So this is saying very clearly, against the Lord and against the Christ, the anointed one, the king. Then they say, here's the quote from the world, the nations, let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. Meaning, they see, well, look right here. Look, there it is. This is the way history is going to work. God controls history. He is going to return. He is going to have a kingdom reign. And he is going to solve the world's problems without a political party, without a vote. He's just going to do it his own way. And if you're a believer, you rejoice. If you're an unbeliever, you call that bondage. You call that not getting your own way. You call it chains and fetters. We want to throw off these shackles of a God who controls the universe. Well, that's what they want, because they want to do it their own way. They want to be in charge. Verse 4, how does God respond to that? His heart is broken, and he weeps and cries for them. Now, the one enthroned in heaven laughs. Yeah, you can't break this chain. The Lord scoffs at them. He mocks them. Pay attention. I'm in control. There's only one way of survival, and that is to follow the truth, the foundation. Then he rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. In other words, he terrifies them by saying, I've already chosen my king, my anointed one, my Messiah. He will rule you. And there's no question about it. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. He goes on, and then we can see some more there about how they're supposed to respond. The classic part is right in verse 12, where it says, kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you be destroyed in your way, for his wrath can flare up in a moment. In other words, when it says kiss the Son, that's the anointed one. That's the Messiah. That means pay homage to him. Kneel before him and recognize him as king, because, well, are you sure we should? Well, you see, his anger can flare up in a moment. He's got a short fuse. Now, understand, we got Jesus, meek and mild, coming to die on the cross. But he came to be the Savior. When he returns as the king, it's going to be, what's your choice? Well, I don't know, sure I've decided. He's at the end of his rope. I mean, look, 6,000 years. It's like, it'll flare up in a moment. So that's the debate, and that's the contest that's been going on. So now we go back to Joel chapter 3. Now listen, wherever you place ourselves, our current situation, you know, I would put it towards the end of the church age right here. This is the same world we live in. The nations are still not very excited about the Messiah, someone coming and taking over all the kingdoms of the world, and they're not very excited about Israel, because when Israel returns, it's a sign that, the Messiah is getting ready to come and deliver his people. So as long as Israel's gone, this whole hocus-pocus, chain bondage thing of the Lord, it's probably just a Jewish fable. But when Israel can be dispersed, put in bondage, and then they resurface, and they can't get driven out of the land, and they just keep staying and staying, it's like a sign that, well, maybe we're not in control of history ourselves. Chapter 3, verse 2 at the end, there I will enter into judgment against them, the nations, concerning my inheritance, my people Israel. For they scattered my people among the nations and divided up my land. Now again, that's the land of Israel. We call it Palestine today. Do you know why we call it Palestine today? Because in 70 AD, 40 years after 30 AD, 70 AD, the Romans came in and dispersed the Jews, destroyed Jerusalem, and so that they could remove any historical connection to the Jews to the land, because Rome's intention was to eliminate the Jews from history. We disperse them, we sell them as slaves, then we're going to call their land, we're not going to call it the Jewish land or Judea, we're going to call it Palestine, after the Israel's historic enemies, the Philistines. So Palestine, the land of Palestine, is named after the Philistines by the Romans between 70 and 135 AD, and they put it on their map, Palestine. It'd be like calling Iowa, let's call it, you know, Little Iraq. It'd be like, what are you trying to do? The Muslims have always lived here. It's like, what? Well, look, it's called Little Iraq. And it's a claim, and what Rome was trying to do was eliminate the Jews and their history and any claim to the land in 70 AD. Okay? But anyway, they divided up my land. They cast lots for my people and traded boys for prostitutes. They sold girls for wine that they might drink. Now, what have you against me? Now, notice what is mentioned here. O Tyre and Sidon and all you regions of Philistia. Translating that in today's newspaper, that says, now what have you against me, O Lebanon, and all you regions of the Gaza Strip? That is, the Philistia is the Gaza Strip, and Tyre and Sidon is Lebanon. So you understand, this was written by Joel back before, you know, 600 BC, 700 BC. It was a historical situation coming all the way through time, and in the future, God is addressing at the time of judgment. That's after the church age and after the seven-year tribulation. He's addressing the Gaza Strip and the land of Lebanon and says, what have you against me? What is your problem with what I'm doing with history? And so we go back into the Old Testament, and it's the Gaza Strip and Lebanon. We look into the future, and it's the Gaza Strip and Lebanon. And then we read our newspapers today, and it's the Gaza Strip and Lebanon. You see, there's a continuity through this whole thing. Now, I'm not saying that there's any prophecy in here about what's happening today. It's just that the Old Testament, the church age, and the future judgment is all still pivoting around the same type of events. And he goes on and says, you are repaying me for something I have done. If you are paying me back, I will swiftly and speedily return on your own heads what you have done. For you took my silver and my gold and carried off my finest treasures to your temples. You sold the people of Judah and Jerusalem to the Greeks that you might send them far from their homeland. See, I'm going to rouse them out of the places to which you sold them. Meaning the Jews, you dispersed them, but I'm going to bring them back. And I will return on your own heads what you have done. I will sell your sons and daughters to the people of Judah, and they will sell them to the Sabaeans, a nation far away. The Lord has spoken. Now watch this verse. Proclaim this among the nations. Prepare for war. Rouse the warriors. Let all the fighting men draw near and attack. Look at this verse. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Now, you all know the verse because they're always quoting this. Even, you know, liberal media quotes it. You know, going to turn your swords into plows. You know, we're going to stop war and just have agriculture. God says, no, before that, now listen, that is a verse that God spoke himself. But he's talking about the millennium. When the king returns, he establishes world peace. Then he will give the proclamation. There's no need for spears and swords. Go ahead and make plows and pruning hooks, because if there's any war going to take place, I will be the warrior. I will start and end any war. It is going to be the Messiah. So this time, world disarmament will be a very good idea in the millennium. World disarmament before that is foolishness. In fact, the Lord says here to the nations, prepare for war. If you've got agricultural equipment, you better figure out a way to shoot a missile with it. Let the weakling say, I am strong. Come quickly, all you nations from every side, and assemble there. And then we go on talking more about the end that we see right here. Now, that's kind of introduce what we're talking about tonight. I'm going to shoot through these notes, see what happens. A lot of times you hear things on the news, and it's like, I wish I understood what was taking place. I wish I had some kind of background. Again, this is a quick background. It helps me when I see it like this. But here's the situation. Israel. We know in 70 AD, Israel was dispersed by the Romans. Again, in 135, there's another dispersion. And they were sold. And they supposedly should have just disappeared from history. That's what happens to people that are just sold off into slavery. They get blended into other cultures and adapted, and they just lose their bloodline and they no longer exist as a people. That's what happened to the Philistines and the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Romans and all of Julius Caesar's descendants. They're all just, they're gone. They're just married into everybody else's cultures and races and stuff. But the Jews, of all these ancient people, the Jews were sold into all those countries. They maintained their identity so that in the 1900s, they could surface again and say, hey, we're still here. After 2,000 years. I mean, you don't have a homeland. You don't have a temple. You don't have any way of organizing yourself except by having the tradition of the Old Testament that they will not let go of, a promise of a Messiah who will come and deliver them. And they just kept hanging on to it. 2,000 years is a long time. But after World War I, November 2nd, 1917, the British were given a mandate from the Balfour Declaration for the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people. So that was what the British were to do, go play, find a place for the Jewish people who have been dispersed in all these nations, and they're living with in Britain, they're living in Germany, they're living in America, they're living wherever they can go, but they're still a people, they need a land. So here, I apologize for my drawing, that's why I gave you some maps. There would be, this is Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. This is the land of Israel, Palestine. Egypt's down here. This would be Lebanon up here. This is very rough drawing. Syria is over here. Lebanon in the Old Testament would be Phoenicia. Israel's over here. This is going to become Jordan. Of course, then you got Iraq over here, and Iran is further over up on the wall. And so they took a land, and they're going to make this declaration. Palestine was divided into two districts. The Jews were to live on the west side. This is the Jewish land over here, the west side. And all the Arabs and Palestinians who were living in the land at that time, they're called Palestinians because they live in the land of Palestine. But they're really just Arabs living in the land. Okay. So now they're supposed to live over here on this side. They divided this land. Jews, Arabs. Now, first of all, do you understand how difficult that was? This is not just an empty parking lot, just a desert with, hey, let's live here in the desert. That would be like taking Iowa, drawing a line down the middle of it, say, if you're an Iowan, move over here. We're going to give the western half to name a group of people, and they're going to move in over here. And your house happens to be on the west side of Des Moines, which is in the western half, so you're moving into, East Des Moines or something, or further east. But I don't want to go. I'm sorry. The British have decided this. So now I understand the hostility right away. In 1946, a Palestinian Arab state, Jordan, was formed on the east. That was over here. But in 1947, the UN, of course. Now, one of the problems with this whole thing, again, how will this ever be resolved? I'm going to show you some things here. And again, the Bible's true. History is accurate. And then I'm going to bring it all together, and you're going to go, what is he talking about? So just trust the Bible, keep track of history, and then my opinion, make sure you put that on the shelf by itself. But you're going to negotiate. The Arabs didn't like that. So the UN's going to get involved. Say, okay. We can understand you're upset. So we will then go ahead, and we'll portion out another part over here called the West Bank. And this is going to be part. This is also for the Arabs over here. So all of a sudden, Israel's territory is getting smaller. But it, well, fine, okay, whatever. 80% of their land was desert, by the way, that they did get. 80% of it is going to come down into this area of Israel. We'll see the map. Well, look right there on the map. You can see the grayish part right there. That's what was left of Israel. They got just that grayish part. They lost, most of Jerusalem and all that. So anyway, the UN stepped in and says, we're going to divide this up also. So they're ready to start. They become a nation. The day they became a nation, 1948, the day Israel was declared its independence, the armies of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and Iraq. So here we go. Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, and what else? Oh, Jordan, and Iraq all attacked. And they've got too much land. And so listen, when you look at the conflict today, there's one simple way of understanding why things aren't working. The Arabs are only going to be satisfied when the nation of Israel is no longer a nation. That's the answer. That's the only answer that they want. Well, Israel is a nation. And even, and listen, if man, watch, and this is where you've got to wonder what is taking place. Is mankind trying to make Israel a nation? Because where do we put these people? And is mankind ahead of the ball game? And they should be just waiting for God to say, okay, here, God do it. Or is God controlling history, as we saw here, and he's moving on the nations through America and Britain to give Israel their land back? Is that a move of God? Now understand, you've got an opinion, but if it's just the work of man, then of course God's not involved in this at all. But if God is controlling history and bringing Israel back, then, even if he isn't right now, he will. I guess my point, if the Arabs want Israel to cease to exist, that's fine. But God has said over and over again, they are. And so they may be fighting against man's will today, but ultimately God is going to bring Israel back, if it's today or later. Here's the boundaries after 1948 and the peace agreement. They had a war with all five nations attacked Israel. And when they got done, look it, they expanded their territory. The only place they didn't go was there's this little place down here that was controlled by Egypt, which was known as the Gaza Strip. and the western West Bank, right? Or, yeah, West Bank over here, which is controlled by Jordan. And you can see on this next map, you can see where those they're under control of Egypt and Jordan. Turn the page. Years go by. I guess one of the things I want you to notice is what is taking place right now in history, right now in your newspapers, is some people, again, and they may be right, but it's like, oh, the rapture must be near. The Lord's return must be close. I think it is. But if you're going by the fact that Israel's being attacked by nations, then that began in 1948. And, well, look at 1967, what happens? The Six-Day War. The Six-Day War began with attacks from, there's your arrows on that first map, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, all attacking Israel. And after the Six-Day War of 1967, the next map shows you Israel's territory. They don't want them to have a land, so they fight Israel for 6 days. When they get done, Israel's map looks something like this, and included... And includes the Sinai Peninsula, which was Egypt when they started the war. It's like, don't mess with Israel. And it's like, all these nations attack, and when Israel fights for 6 days, it's like, oh, we just got bigger. Now, in the peace treaty at the end, or during the next few months, Israel is going to take to appease Egypt, say, okay, you can have this back. And they're going to give Egypt their land back. Since that time, Egypt has been basically kind of happy. Okay, I mean, just, you know, in a nutshell, they're okay. In other words, they've learned their lesson. 1973. I guess Egypt here is going to attack again. 1973, you've got on the top, you've got Syria attacking. And again, I've got two maps of Syria's attack. And it's the Golan Heights, which is up here. You hear about the Golan Heights. The Golan Heights is this area right here, you see, that is on the border between Israel, Lebanon, and Syria. So it's kind of a hot spot, the Golan Heights, not a good place to live. They attacked, and you can see Egypt coming across there into the Sinai Peninsula. Again, I think it was after this war where they give the Sinai back. But turn the page. And on page 5, there's 1973 ceasefire lines. And again, the color didn't come off real good. But you can see how the Sinai's back in Egypt's territory, and that's when that was given back. And turn the page. Then in 1982... there's a problem with the border of Lebanon right here. Israel's moving up into this area here, and there's a group called the PLO. Now, one of the problems we have here in all these nations, for example, Arafat was in Jordan, and Arafat formed a terrorist group, if you would, or started a civil war in Jordan and challenged the King Hussein. And what ended up happening was you've got Arafat, who's really a nobody within Jordan, but he's fighting within starting his own civil war, and ends up they're both being end up being recognized as leaders within Jordan. So you've got Jordan and the national government, but then you've got Arafat and his little terrorist group happening. In Lebanon, in 1982, you've got the Lebanese government, but then you've got this group called the PLO who's occupying. Same thing that we had in Afghanistan. You've got Afghanistan, but then you've got within Afghanistan, you've got a little terrorist operation going on, and that's what's happening today. You've got Lebanon, the Lebanese people, but then down in the bottom down here on this border, you've got a terrorist group that's fighting, being supplied by other countries to fight against Israel. So it's really tough because you've got nations, but you've also got groups living within those nations. Well, in 1982, there's your border. You can see Lebanon up there, Israel on the bottom, and then there's this area right here where Israel's going to withdraw. They're going to go back. The UN says, we want you to step back and have peace. Well, let's read this. 1978, under American pressure, Israel withdrew from southern Lebanon and were replaced by UN forces. The PLO, though, continued its hold in southern Lebanon. Again, that's not the Lebanese government. That's the PLO living in Lebanon. Civilians and UN peacekeepers were killed as the fighting continued. June 3rd, 1982, the PLO attempted to assassinate Israel's ambassador to Great Britain. June 3rd. June 4th and 5th, Israel bombed PLO base all the way up into Beirut. Now, if you look at the map, you can see Beirut. But also notice Tyre and Sidon that we mentioned in Joel's prophecy. The PLO responded by bombing Galilee. June 6, 1982, Israel invades Lebanon and drives all the way to Beirut. So now Israel, you can see how that the white part there has gone all the way up towards Beirut. And by 2000, Israel withdraws its troops from the security zones in southern Lebanon. So they held that position for like 20 years. And then to make peace, to make everybody happy, Israel says, okay. In other words, they extended their territory further into Lebanon. And just like they extended all the way down to Egypt, and Egypt's getting all mad, they gave it back. Okay, fine. Then they extend all the way up to Lebanon, but to negotiate, they backed off. And we just had it happen recently with the Gaza Strip. We just give it over to them. And it continues like this. 2000, Israel withdraws its troops from the security zone. 2000, Hezbollah then began to demand an area at the junction of the borders of Syria, Lebanon, and Israel. That's within the Golan Heights right here. Israel backs off and says, fine. First thing PLO does is they want, or Hezbollah wants more land. 2002, Hezbollah scales security fence and starts killing Israelites on the highways. 2002, Hezbollah now is assisted by Al-Qaeda in Lebanon because Al-Qaeda's got to find a new place to live because they've been driven out of Afghanistan, so now they're starting to filter into Lebanon. And so now Hezbollah is basically backed up by Al-Qaeda and all. But anyway, that's the situation. What is very interesting, just to put this in perspective, is Israel is surrounded, and Israel keeps being attacked, not so much by nations, but by little groups within the nation, that the nation, well, that's not us, that's another group within us, and they can, you know, whatever's going on under the table, who knows. But nonetheless, Israel continues to stand. Now, we have the same situation happening today. Another attack from the Gaza Strip and from Lebanon. Now, the result of this, who knows what's going to happen? I don't know what's going to happen. We're going to look at some prophecies here a little bit on what's taking place. But where this goes, I don't know. But as we see this take place, we notice the more they negotiate, the more they try and find peace and cooperate, the more they keep getting run over. It appears there's only one way for Israel to solve any of these problems, and that is to have a war, take possession, and say, it's over. It's our land now. Just like other countries take over land. You look at history. How do people take over lands? How do they take over countries? They invade, they conquer, they take up possession, and as 10, 20, 30, 50 years go by, it's kind of like until someone's strong enough to take it away, they have their land. So Israel, instead of trying to negotiate with, you know, UN, America, British, everybody trying to work with them, it's just take your land and be seated. And that's possibly where this is all going to end up. But let's look at some Bible prophecy, and let's look at this very quickly. Go to Matthew chapter 12. And we're going to go back to our timeline here, and I want to show you where this comes from, why Israel was even dispersed in the first place in 70 AD. If they're God's people, why doesn't he just let them stay? But this has a lot to do with us today as the church and what's going on. In chapter 12 of Matthew, we're on page 7 of your notes, and I'm going to run through these scriptures right here very quickly, and hopefully it adds to your understanding. And again, the Bible is true. History is true. As I put it together, you know, you're going to have to, you know, do the best you can with it. Chapter 12. We have the situation in chapter 12 where in verse 22 where Jesus, it says chapter 12, verse 22, then they brought him a demon-possessed man who was blind and mute, and Jesus healed him so that he could both talk and see. Obviously a miracle. All the people were astonished and they said, could this be the son of David? Indicating, could this be the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed? Is this him? Notice the people are asking that. But when the Pharisees heard this, they said, it'll only be Beelzebub, the prince of demons, that this fellow drives out demons. In other words, the people were wondering, but the leaders, the representatives of the country, said no. Now notice they did not say, no, he's a fake. They didn't say, no, that didn't really happen. They says, no, something amazing happened, but that was an amazing thing by Beelzebub. That's Satan that did that. Now remember, Israel is supposed to be God's representatives on the earth. They're to take the light to all the world. But you understand, when the king comes, Jesus, and he presents himself as the king of the kingdom to his sales representatives, and they say, no, you're not the owner of the company. We work for someone else. And he's trying to sell Pepsi, but they're promoting Coca-Cola. The president of Pepsi is going to say, I need a new company. I need a new sales department. I need new representatives. And that's what's going to, he says, forget it. I can't spread the good news. I can't bring light to the nations with you rejecting me. And so it goes through. Jesus knew their thoughts. He says, every kingdom divided against itself will be ruined, and every city or household divided against itself will not stand. Now, we read that in as far as saint, but actually he's talking about his own company. He says, I can't build a kingdom if we're divided. So he's going to have to make a decision. And we can see this in chapter 13. Obviously, I'm skipping a lot of text there, but we're flowing through the book. Chapter 13 is the beginning of Jesus teaching parables. Up until this time, Jesus taught plainly. He interpreted the law of Moses. He said, you've heard it said, but I say to you. And everybody's taking notes. Everybody's listening. But on this day, after he's been rejected and there's been a clear decision, Jesus has switched directions. Jesus, upon Israel rejecting him, he rejects them and says, I've still got a work to do in the world. And Jesus is now on path to form the church. It's still the kingdom. Understand, the kingdom of God is eternal. For our case, it goes from Adam all the way until Jesus Christ returns and sets up his kingdom. And it's even before and after that. But during this time of history, the kingdom of God is eternal. But how God chooses to manifest his kingdom to the world will change. For example, before, here's Israel. Obviously, we know Israel was the representative. But before that time, there were what we would call, we'll just call them Gentiles today, but there were Gentile prophets. I mean, you know, Noah wasn't a Jew, you know. He was in the line of Abraham, but he wasn't a Jew. Was he in the line of Abraham? Well, yeah, he's in my line. It's everybody's line. It wasn't his line, yeah. It's a dumb statement. But anyway, he chose different ways of representing the kingdom. He is now using today the church age, or the church in this time period right here, to represent himself to the world as the kingdom is being represented. So Jesus, when Israel rejects him, he realizes, I've got to do something different. Now, how long this lasts, we don't know. But Israel's still got promises they will be brought back. Okay. He goes out that says that same day. So notice that same day, chapter 13, verse 1. So we're not like years later. That same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat by the lake. Such large crowds gathered around him that he got into a boat and sat in it while all the people stood on the shore. Then he told them many things in parables. In other words, at this point, Jesus begins to tell parables. And the disciples, we're going to read here in just a moment, the disciples are going to be like, what are you doing? Listen to this great story. Now, we've heard it so many times, it makes sense to us. But just put this in real life. Here's the great teacher, Jesus. People crowd around. He's got to get in a boat and begins to teach. He says, a farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path. The birds came and ate it up. Some fell on the rocky places where it did not have much soil. It sprang up quickly because the soil was shallow. But when the sun came up, the plants were scorched and they withered because they had no root. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up and choked the plants. Still other seed fell on the good soil, where it produced a crop, 100, 60, or 30 times what was sown. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. And in other words, if you can understand that, good luck. Have a nice day. And that, what's like, what? That was it. And it's full of lessons. It's full of principles. But he's no longer teaching the masses. He's teaching the believers. That's what he says. He who has ears, let him hear. If you've got ears, spiritual ears, and you've been keeping up, and you're a believer, you understand what I'm talking about. Well, watch. Watch the disciples. He closes it down and goes backstage. Show's over. The disciples all come running back. Judas probably leading the charge. The disciples came to him and says, why do you speak to people in parables? What was that? No one knows what you're talking about. You sound like a madman. He replied, the knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, remember I'm talking about the kingdom of heaven, the knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven have been given to you, but not to them. Whoever has or whoever understands will be given more, or whoever understands will understand more, and he will have an abundance of information. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. If whoever does not have, in other words, doesn't have understanding, if you're still going to stay back here with Israel and you don't understand what he's talking about, even the little bit of understanding that you've got is no longer going to make sense any longer. It's going to be taken from you. You're going to continue to fall behind. This is why I speak to them in parables. And then he quotes out of Isaiah, though seeing they do not see, though hearing they do not hear. It's part of his plan. I'm going to speak plainly to them, but because they don't have a heart for God, they don't understand it. But blessed, he says in verse 16, but blessed are your eyes because they see and your ears because they hear, for many prophets long to see this. And then in verse 18, he begins to explain it. Now, this is the beginning of the seven kingdom parables. Because now notice, he says in the next verse, 24, Jesus told them another parable. Notice what he says. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed. And he tells them another parable. And he's going to tell them seven parables that are going to reveal or talk about the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven on earth in this new age. In other words, we're living in the kingdom of heaven. We're the representatives of the church, but we're living in a new manifestation, different than Israel's manifestation. And he's going to give them seven teachings here, and we can go through each one of them, but I'll just name them. The first one talks about how the kingdom is going to spread, sowing the word, and he's going to scatter it everywhere. The next one, that there's going to be an enemy is going to come and sow weed among the good seed, and they're to let it grow. So during this next age, as we're teaching the truth, error or falsehoods are also going to be taught. What's God going to do about it? According to this parable, not a thing. Let it grow. Let it grow until the end. He's not going to stamp out evil teaching. He's going to let it grow. The next one, the parable of the mustard seed. It was the smallest seed, but it became the greatest of all the garden plants. In other words, the church is going to begin with 11 guys in Jerusalem after the resurrection, the smallest of the garden seeds, but it's going to grow to become the biggest, and today it is. You look at all the world religions, Christianity is the largest world religion. Judaism was big. Muslims weren't even around. Islam wasn't even a religion. But at this time, the church took over and now spread around the world. It was the smallest, but it became the greatest. Yeast, parable of the yeast, the kingdom of heaven, he says in verse 33, is like the kingdom of heaven is like yeast, a woman mixing in a large amount of dough until it worked all through the dough. This kingdom of God through the church is going to spread into every part of society, every nation, every race, every economic level. Christianity is going to go everywhere. Once it's in the world, it's going to permeate the entire loaf. Then going down to verse 44, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. So there's now something about this next phase of the kingdom, and this is the fifth one, it's going to be a treasure. But this treasure is going to be hidden. So there's something during this age, this next phase of the kingdom, that is going to be hidden in the earth, and no one's going to be able to see it. And what he's referring to here, because the next one he's going to talk about a pearl of great worth. And the pearl refers to the forming of the church, but the treasure that is hidden is Israel. There's going to be Deuteronomy, and Moses calls Israel the treasured nation. It is going to be buried and hidden, and he tells the story right here. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasured field. When a man found it, he hid it and sold all that he had and went in joy and bought the field or bought the world and got Israel too, but Israel was hidden. And then, of course, the pearl. And the last one, it talks about the final judgment of still similar to even Israel's teaching that in the end, everyone's going to be gathered in and separated, the good on one, the bad on the other. And those are the seven kingdom parables that tell what's going to take place. Jesus asks in verse 51, he says to his disciples, have you understood all these things? Have you understood the next seven phases that I'm going to introduce in this next phase of the kingdom? Yes, they says. Then he said to them in verse 52, therefore, every teacher of the law who has been instructed about the kingdom of heaven from these seven kingdom parables is like the owner of a house who brings out of his storeroom new treasures as well as old. In other words, if you don't have these seven kingdom parables, you can only teach from the old treasures. But if you understand these, you can teach from the New Testament and bring out treasures. But you can also go back in your storeroom and bring out things out of the Old Testament. You can teach both because they line up. But if you don't have this, this isn't going to make any sense. He's telling them, you are going to be the teachers of the law. Now, go to chapter 16 if you don't mind. Continuing on the flow, they've graduated. This is their graduation ceremony. It's at Caesarea Philippi. They're up by the gates of Hades, which is a rock formation it's like a pagan shrine called the gates of hell, the gates of Hades. They have sacrifices there, and they have little shrines of idols. It's a big rock formation. It's north of Israel. It's up in Lebanon. It's outside of the land of Israel. It's in Gentile territory. So he takes his disciples out of Israel for graduation ceremonies up to Gentile territory. And we're up in verse 17. Well, you know, in verse 15. He asked them, who am I? You know, what do people say that I am? They say, well, they say this. They say Elijah. They say one of the dead prophets. Verse 15, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter, you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One, the Son of the living God. Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, For this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock, again, we're probably referring to the gates of Hades they're standing on, I will build my church. I'm going to build this church on the gates of Hades. There's not a pagan religion. In other words, he's going to the Gentiles. Are you still with me? He's in Caesarea, Gentile territory, and he says, on this rock, I'm going to build my church. Now, there's now talking about the church. In other words, he's saying, I'm going to begin a work now, and we're going to go to the Gentile territories. We're a small group, but we're going to go to the Gentile territories, and whatever their religion is, we're moving in. And the gates of hell, or the gates of Hades, will not overcome it. What we're about to do, they're going to leave Israel and go around the world with the gospel. And nothing is going to be able to stop the spread. And notice what he says in this verse 19. I will give you the keys of the kingdom. In other words, Israel had the keys up until chapter 12. He then gives them to the church and says, I'm going to give you the keys and you will be now my representatives. You will be driving the kingdom now until we make the next switch. And that is where we're at today. Now go to Romans chapter 11. We are now in that church age. That began back when Jesus resurrected and sent the Spirit of God. Romans chapter 11. And we are, I think, and you know, it says no man knows the day or the hour, but you will know the seasons. I think we're nearing the end of the church age. I mean, it makes sense if you go 2,000, 2,000, 2,000. It's been about 2,000 years. I mean, that's not the only reason. We also now see Israel beginning to return. Well, we've had for since about last 80 years. But I do want you to notice in Romans chapter 11, Paul tells them that one of the mysteries is that Israel will be set aside. But I want you to look in chapter 11, verse 11. Again, I ask, did they stumble, that's Israel, did they stumble as to fall beyond recovery? Because God has gone to the Gentiles, the church age. Is Israel done? They'll never recover. He says, not at all. Rather, because of their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make Israel envious. We're doing what Israel's supposed to be doing. Well, the church is supposed to be doing what Israel's supposed to be doing. Laodicea age ends the same way, you know, that Israel, if you read in Revelation 3. But nonetheless, we have their job. Flip over to chapter 11, verse 25. I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery. And a mystery is, in the New Testament, is something that is true, but it's been hidden. It refers to fraternity information, like if you join a fraternity, if you join a secret club, this group is in the know. They have the information, and it doesn't just public knowledge isn't available. But you've got to go through the series of events and vows and commitments, and now you're on the inside, and they'll tell you their secret information. That is exactly what that Greek word means. It's secret information for the fraternity brothers. And so he says, I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery, this secret information. Brothers, so that you may not be conceited. Then here it is. Israel has experienced a hardening in part until the full number of Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved. In other words, he says, let me tell you the mystery. What's going on with Israel and the church? He says, it's just recently been revealed in the church age. Israel is being set aside because the church is going to have its ministry. When the full number of Gentiles has responded, when God is finished, Israel's going to return to finish up its ministry that God has for them. So there we have it. You can read on through there as they begin to talk about other things there. Now, are there any questions at this time? Anybody? I've got some more verse I want to take a look at, but does anybody have any questions? The 144,000, the way I would put it together, is at the beginning of the tribulation. Because they're going to counteract the Antichrist. Now, what takes place here, if we can do this with Israel, you see, in my mind sometimes this the return of Israel has to take place after the church age. So, for example, there's the cross. And then when the church began, On the day of Pentecost, Israel was set aside. The church will end with the rapture, and then Israel will come back into force. And that's when the 144,000 will go into operation to spread the gospel. But understand, 30 AD was the day of Pentecost. Israel's destruction, and we'll look at the prophecies here in just a minute, didn't take place until 70 AD. In other words, the church was in operation for 40 years as Israel. The church was taken off as Israel was declining. There was a 40-year overlap. I mean, Israel, the temple didn't, the Spirit of God didn't show up and the temple blow up. The Spirit of God showed up and they still were, the temple still going on. In fact, Jesus gave them 40 years. So if that's the way it ended, the rapture is obviously going to be in a twinkling of an eye and a flash. But, and then of course, the church is gone. But there may be an overlap of Israel. That's why we can look at the return from 1948 and where Israel's at today as being the beginning of Israel, of these things that are going to take place. And I used to think that it had to be, you know, just stop and go. But obviously the situation is going to be planned for. Is that? So I think we may be, in other words, I think we may be seeing the end of the church age as we finish up our work and the return of Israel taking place simultaneously. No, no, they because it says all Israel will be saved. You mean?
So the elect.
We'll get into that eventually. But Israel, all of Israel as a nation, is going to be deceived by the Antichrist because that's why they signed the peace treaty with him for the 7 years. Daniel talks about many will sign the treaty with this, the coming leader. Jesus in John chapter 5 is going through and gives reasons. Witnesses or testimonies why he is the Messiah. He's arguing with the Pharisees. He says, my testimony is not valid. He says, because I tell you I'm the Messiah, but I understand why you wouldn't believe me. You know, in a court of law, yes, are you innocent? Yeah, he's innocent. Okay, well, then he's free. You got to have some kind of testimony. Why do you think you're innocent? And then he lists off John the Baptist, the Old Testament, God the Father has spoken, the Holy Spirit. And his big one, he says, the works that I do. He says, Moses himself testifies about me. These are my witnesses. But then he says something very interesting. He says, but you will not accept these witnesses, but yet you will accept one who comes in his own name. And that's, he's referring to the Antichrist. That Israel will reject the king with all these witnesses and testimonies saying, I am the Messiah. And they say, no, we don't want that. But then the Antichrist will show up and say, I'm the Messiah. And they'll go, oh, well, we've been waiting. And they will sign a peace treaty with him that will give them 7 years of peace and the land and restore the temple services. So they will all, as a nation, will all be deceived. So we're talking about, we got several things happening. But at the same time, or near the same time, 144,000 Jews are sealed by the Spirit of God. I believe it takes place at the rapture. When the church leaves, God's got it, goes right back to Israel. Just like the Spirit came on the church on the day the church began, when the church is gone and Israel's now, I'll make this statement. I believe this is a true statement. Back in the Old Testament, there were no Gentile prophets after Israel became a nation. For example, Balaam, right around in Moses' day, it was a Gentile prophet, but he was probably the last Gentile prophet because God is now working with Israel. All the prophets, anything he speaks comes through Israel. That's his choice. When he began the church on the day of Pentecost, there's no prophets in Israel any longer. There are no prophets. There's nobody speaking or doing the work of God in this world but the church of Jesus Christ. We, the believers in Jesus Christ, filled with the Spirit, are the ones. He's not working any other way. We are his representatives. When we are gone at the rapture, 144,000 are sealed with the Spirit, and now he's back in operation with these people. But notice, this takes place at the same time the nation has been deceived by the Antichrist. So when it says all of Israel will be saved, obviously it doesn't mean every one last one of Israel will be saved. I mean, it's like, what are we talking about? And by the time we get here, Israel are those who believe in Jesus Christ. Israel is those who accept the truth, including Gentiles. In this case, the 7-year tribulation is going to sift out the believers and the non-believers in Israel. Many of the Israel are going to be non-believers. And that was contrary to Jewish teaching because Jews taught, for example, that Abraham sat at the gates of Hades, and whenever a Jew would approach Hades, he'd say, no, you're one of my children, you go over to paradise. He would never let anyone go into Hades or a place of judgment, because all Israel's going to be saved. Well, that's not a correct understanding, because they have to be believers. So this whole seven-year period is going to be a sifting, but yet when it's all said and done, the nation itself, after about the three-and-a-half-year mark, when the Antichrist breaks the treaty, the nation begins to realize, through it's called the time of Jacob's trouble, trials and tests will bring many of the nation, many of Israel, to the place of decision of like, man, we've got to look for the Savior. And they'll begin to turn to Jesus Christ as those last 3.5 years go on, and especially as they get to the last days when Jesus, before Jesus returns. You read that in Zechariah, where it says, I'll open up a fountain, and it says they'll weep for one as one weeps for an only lost son. Israel will realize what they have done, that they've rejected Jesus Christ for all these years. And so there will be mass revival, and in that sense, all of Israel will be saved. But there are still obviously going to be some people, the believers, that. But the nation itself will have a huge revival at the beginning and throughout the tribulation. Now, that's a tough verse where it says all of Israel will be saved, because you just think, well, then all Israel is going to get saved. But then, of course, you got years of history of Israel that hasn't been saved, you know. Well, let's do this, if you don't mind. I was going to look in Luke and show you where Jesus prophesied the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. But we'll finish up with this right here. Let's go to Ezekiel very quickly. Ezekiel 37, 38, and 39, and then we'll be done. And this is, a prophecy in chapter 37, 38, and 39 of future events. These events here have not taken place historically. There's no commentators in any commentaries as they read this or study this in chapter 38. This invasion, it's Gog and Magog. There's nothing happened in history they can correlate with. It hasn't happened. So this is a future event. The question is, when in the future does this event take place, or do you read it literally? Is it supposed to be spiritualized? And of course, I'm going to stay with it literally. But I'm looking at this last map right here on the very back of your notes. And what we have here in this section now is chapter 37. And chapter 37 is talking about the dry bones. 38 and 39 is talking about an invasion of Israel by Gog and Magog. Chapter 40 begins to introduce the millennial temple, or the rest of the book now talks about the thousand-year reign of Christ, or the millennium. And so what you have is a sequence of events. And you can separate these chapters from each other if you want to, and put this back here and put that over there and say that doesn't mean anything. Or you can just let the thing flow as Ezekiel finishes up his book describing the last days of history into the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. So we begin with chapter 37 in Ezekiel. And this is God now speaking to Ezekiel. He says, chapter 37, verse 1, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit and set me in the middle of a valley. It was full of bones. He led me back and forth among them. I saw a great many bones on the floor of the valley, bones that were very dry. Son of man, can these bones live? So if you look down into a verse, where is it at? It's in there. We'll get to it here in a minute. But God clearly identifies these bones as the nation of Israel. So these dry bones are Israel, and they're in a dead state. They're the nation of Israel that they're dead. They've been in the grave so long, they're not just bones, they're dry bones. 11, verse 11. Oh, yeah. Then he said to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Whole house means all 12 tribes. Verse 4. Then he said to me, prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you, and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord. Now notice right there, then you will know. Then the nation will So one of the signs to Israel that God is God and the Lord is the Lord is when they see themselves return and God begins to work with them again. Then he says, then you will know. Because many of the Israelites, they don't understand many of these things. Well, let's go on. So I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. So now they've got these skeletons with flesh standing there, ready to go. They've now occupied space. Maybe it refers to the fact that Israel's now back in the land, but they're really, you know, there's no real breath, and there's no real vision about them. There's no real life. They're just in the land. They're ready to go. And these bodies are ready to go. Then he said to me, prophesy to the breath. Prophesy, son of man, and say to it, this is what the sovereign Lord says, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe into these slain, that they may live. So in other words, there's going to be a coming together. If when you just say the body, which is the body without the spirit is dead. And then there's going to be the life come into the body, and it's becoming a living nation again. But we're not even there yet. To the place in verse 11, then he says, these are the bones of the house of Israel, these bones. They say, our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We are cut off. Therefore, prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. O my people, I am going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. Then you, my people, will know that I am the Lord. When I open your graves and bring you up from them, I will put my spirit in you and you will live and I will settle you in your own land. And the last thing he says, my spirit, and that would refer to an awakening or a born again of recognizing the presence of Jesus Christ. So it's like a three-step process. But nonetheless, Israel is going to come back. Now, as we continue to read through this, we get to verse chapter 38. And now it says, the word of the Lord came to me. Now, first of all, this coming out, the dry bones coming together, I would assume, and as I'm teaching this tonight, is the return of Israel for the tribulation and the millennium, or what we may be witnessing here in the last 100 years. It is not the coming back from Babylon. I mean, there's other places. It could be the return from Babylon, but it is not. Because when Babylon came back, the 10 tribes were still dispersed by the Assyrians. They've never come back from the 700 dispersion by Assyria. They have never come. They weren't dispersed by the Romans. They have been dispersed ever since that time. And this is the bringing back of the whole house. So this is a day in the future. So now they're back. Let's say this speaks of our time right now. Verse chapter 38. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Prophesy against him and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. I will turn you around and put hooks in your jaws and bring you out with your whole army, your horses, your horsemen, fully armed, and a great horde with large and small shields, all of them brandishing their swords. So there's Gog and Magog is this nation. It's a group of people. It refers to the northern people that settled north of Iran up in Russia area. And again, I've got it written on there, Meshech and Magog. That may not be exact good terminology, but the people are from the Russian area. That's for sure. And he says, speak to Gog and Magog. And they're going to come down. They're going to come down into, as you see there, they're going to come down into Israel and attack Israel. Again, this has never happened, and it happens after the dry bones have come together. And it happens before the millennium. So I'm telling you, it's got to happen sometime between now and the return of Jesus Christ. There's only 7 years of the tribulation, and then the final days of the church age that's going to take place. It's going to happen, you know, during that time period. If we're living in the last generation of the church, which we could be, but we don't know for sure, then this thing is going to happen in the next, 10 to 50 years. Okay? And
between now and the rapture or the return?
Between now and... between now and the millennium.
Oh, okay.
Because chapter 40 is the introduction of the millennium. But I do not think this is not happen in the tribulation, because there's some things in here. It talks about they're going to use the weapons for 7 years for fuel. So I believe this invasion here takes place the final days of the church age. So I think we may be witnessing the preparing of this. Well, let's just watch this. No, but really interestingly, here's the nation. It's a northern nation coming down. It's coming out of Russia. It's not, you know, Russia or USSR, but it's a group of people from that area. Notice who comes with them. Verse 5. Persia, which is Iran, Cush, which is Ethiopia, and Put, which is Libya, will be with them, all with shields and helmets. Also Gomer, that would be like up in Asia, you can see on the map, that would be Asia Minor, Turkey, and all its troops, and Beth Togarmah, which is, again, southern Russia in that area. So you can see on the map there, those are basically the terrorist states. Those are the terrorist states that are going to come against Israel. Now, we may think this is going to take place, like, tomorrow. I mean, look at the map. I mean, that's exactly the way the world has been set up. But again, that's not surprising because we go into start with Joel, Old Testament prophecy, talking about the future, and now we're back in here, and this is fitting into this also. But as we read through this, he tells him in verse 7, "Get ready, be prepared, you and all the hordes gathered about you, and take command of them. After many days," this is talking many days in the future, "you'll be called to arms. In future years, you will invade a land that has recovered from war, whose people were gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate." See what this is setting the stage for? This is setting the stage for Israel, an attack on Israel, after they've been dispersed by war, which would be the Roman War of 70 AD. They've been brought back. They've recovered. They're living in their land. They had been brought out from the nations, and now all of them live, notice this, live in safety. You and all your troops and many nations with you will go up, advancing like a storm. You will be like a cloud covering the land. They're coming against Israel. Similar to 1948, similar to 1967, 1973, similar to what's breaking loose now, but not quite as serious. Verse 10, "This is what the Sovereign Lord says. On that day, thoughts will come into your mind, and you'll devise an evil scheme. You will say, I will invade a land of unwalled villages. I will attack a peaceful and unsuspecting people." Now, right here, I've got to stop and show you these words right here. What we just read, he says, you and all your troops, in verse 9, and many nations will go up advancing. No, it's the verse before that. Recovered from war, gathered from many nations, long days. They had been brought up from the nations, and now are at the end of verse 10. "And now all of them live in safety." Now, that is not describing Israel today. That has not described Israel, my friends, since 1948. They've never lived in safety. And then Gog, as he's speaking, describes them as peaceful and unsuspecting people. That has not happened since 1948. Well, but it could be, except now you're going to have to change it into... It may refer to us. It may refer to our situation as unsuspecting. Exactly. And then it goes on and says, without walls and without gates and bars. And they just got them trying to build a wall. So now it can't be Israel today. Yes.
Yeah, but now verse 10 says, mm-hmm. The Lord God says, on that day it will come to pass that the thoughts will arise in your mind that this is so.
Right.
So maybe he's saying, you think you're going to a place.
Right. That's true too.
Like that.
A peaceful. But what world leader today would think that there are peaceful and unsuspecting people? Although, you know, we talk about that report, you know.
But they're pretty much the West most of the time, giving the lands back. And,
right, that's true, right. I mean, it may be. You do have to then consider over here where it says at the end of verse 8, now all of them live in safety. They had been brought out from the nations and now all of them live in safety. And again, they are, in a sense, living in their own land. So this may indeed be talking about, you know, we may be prepared for this. Exactly.
But is that verse 10 saying to, is the Lord God saying to the evil north nations, come, mm-hmm. You think they're places.
That could be. Mm-hmm. Yep.
In your mind, you think that you're going against the people that are, say, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, one of two things is going to happen. Either this is ready to take place right now at any moment, or... like I was saying last night, what would have to take place for Israel to ever get to this point right here of where they're unwalled and they're actually unsuspecting is they're going to have to win a war, like win this war, establish their borders for a period of time, 10, 15, 20 years, so that they become a nation, recognized by nations. And all these other terrorist states that we just saw right here are set back by Israel's war, meaning Israel's going to have to do something to set them back where they got not going to mess with them for 10, 15, 20 years. But they have never forgot, and after a period of time, they regroup and they come down and they invade like a storm, come down and try and take Israel out. Well, as the story goes right here, God intervenes and Gog and Magog are wiped out, not by Israel. They're wiped out by God before Israel has a chance to even launch a missile. They come in and Israel's waiting for them. And then all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose and Gog and Magog are gone. They die in the mountains of Israel on their attack. And then it says verse 9 of chapter 39, the story continues in chapter 39, then those who live in the towns of Israel will go out and use the weapons for fuel and burn them up. The small and large shields, the bows and arrows, the war clubs and spears, that's all the atomic weapons that are laying around that they just transfer into fuel. For 7 years they'll use them for fuel. And again, that would set the stage for the seven-year tribulation, which would then put this event as an opening event for the tribulation and the final events of the church age that would take place. The amazing thing is, as you look at this map, it's the stage, the table, the chessboard is almost set exactly like this. We got a few more things for Russia to... I mean, Russia is going to end up siding, according to this, the northern people up towards Russia are going to end up siding with the terrorist states, and they're going to come down to Israel. The other thing that they talk about here, I do want to point this out as we go through this. Where does it got in here? Verse 13. It says, Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish and all her villages will say to you, have you come to plunder? So in other words, Sheba, that's Yaman, and Dedan is southern Egypt. That's basically Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia and Tarshish, which is the western side of the Mediterranean Sea, speaking of the western world. And it also says Tarshish and all her villages. You know, so anything that came out of the western part of the Mediterranean Sea, which is, you know, the western Europe and western world, Saudi Arabia and the western world say to Gog and Magog and all the terrorists, say, have you come to plunder? You're doing this. You're not in retaliation. You've come to plunder. And they're you know, it's like the UN saying, wait, this isn't a good deal. This isn't a good thing to do. So they got some that are standing against, some nations standing against them saying, you shouldn't be doing this. But before there's a chance to react, God intervenes, and it says that everyone will know that the Lord has intervened, and it will change history. The other thing that's interesting is then if this happens right at the end of the church age or at the beginning of the tribulation, this would spiral the Antichrist into coming down to Israel and saying, hey, you know, we'd like maybe make a peace treaty with you, say 7 years. Because he realizes that Israel is a threat to be reckoned with, and he's all friendly with them. They've got fuel for 7 years. The Antichrist signs a 7-year peace treaty. And then one more thing before I close this down, I do want you to notice on this map that still lines up with our world today, two nations that are not attacking Israel. Two nations that from the book of Genesis all the way to the Revelation, two groups of people that have always been a problem for Israel and are their historic classic enemies, those two nations are Egypt and Iran, or Babylon. Iran and Egypt, if this was just, for example, this is just a good Old Testament story about Israel's enemies, man, Egypt and Babylon would be coming at them. But it's not. It's Russia and Libya and Ethiopia. In the Old Testament, in Ezekiel's day, who were these people? These weren't their enemies. They didn't even worry about these people. They were unsaid. They were, like, especially up in Russia in that area, they were barbarians. It's like, who are these people? If this was just taken in Ezekiel's day, he would have said, if it's in his own imagination, he would have said Babylon and Egypt. But on this map, Babylon and Egypt aren't even mentioned. Because if this fits into our timetable, Egypt, like we said earlier tonight, they're pacified. They were given back their land, and they're all right. They don't want any more trouble. And Iraq or Babylon, they're about ready to spin into a democracy. No matter what the papers write, according to this, Babylon or Iraq.
Iraq, not Iran.
Oh, my friends. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Iraq. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I meant Iraq. Babylon. Yep. Yeah, because Iran's right on there. But yeah, thank you, John. But Iraq, if it's been into a democracy, is not going to have any interest in this because they're going to prosper. The free market is going to work. And if it's the beginning of the tribulation, Babylon is going to be rebuilt and it's going to become the most prosperous city in the history of mankind, according to the book of Revelation. If you believe Babylon itself will be rebuilt. I didn't used to think that. because it's just a dust bowl. But now with the things that are taking place, I'm now, listen, I read the Bible literally, except where it's too difficult, then I make it spiritual. And I used to spiritualize Babylon being rebuilt. It's like, that just means the headquarters of the world, wherever that's at. But all of a sudden, it's like, here comes democracy, all the oil fields, and it's like, oh my gosh, that's even literal. So, I mean, it's like, it's hard to, you know, read a literal something when you're so far into the future. But I think, note, it's interesting that Iraq is not on here, nor is Egypt. And I think this whole thing in Iraq is going to work out. It's not going to go back to the terrorists. It's going to become something bigger. Yes?
Kind of interesting, you mentioned Libya, which, if us old enough remember, Muammar was very powerful, and then the U.S. said no and zapped him, and he went undercover. But we really don't know what he's up to.
Oh, okay.
We haven't for about 20 years. So this would make sense.
Because
we know he's an evil man by his history, but he's subdued right now. We don't really know what's going on, so that's kind of interesting.
And when Gog and Magog make that move, it's like, we're in. We've been waiting. Yeah. We've been waiting
been
to make
a
this
Russian
move.
Ally for,
yeah.
Before, that was where he got.
I mean, this looks like front page news right here. I mean, this looks like everything's lining up. Well, any other comments, insights into this? Yes, sir.
I just want to challenge everybody. If this is the way things are starting to boil down, is everybody out doing their job as Christians, evangelizing and spreading the word as we are supposed to?
Yeah, it's a fun story. But yeah, it's like, because, again, we're in that church age. And God showed, we go back to Matthew, I will build my church. And we're the light. He is working through the nations right now through us. And the thing about that is we're equipped. We're anointed. That's our job. So if we will step, he will move. I mean, he wants to do it more than we do. So, yeah, there's a great door of opportunity. All right, I'll pray, and then you guys are free to go. Oh, wait, we got a comment, please.
I have a question. So specifically, who's Gog?
Gog is it's a tough one because you see on the map up there, I put Meshech, some word terminologies. The word studies used to try and stretch Meshech into Moscow and Russia's Magog. Both those are bad studies. That's about 20 years ago when I did that. More recent studies, that's fallen apart. Gog and Magog, if we go back to Genesis, those are names of people that, in fact, if you want to see it, I think I might be able to find it in Genesis chapter 10. They're in the table of nations, the names of these people.